fun route. We will be telling us things about pre-normalization in non-computing quantum field theory.
So, hello, I would like to start by thanking Liz Moin for giving me the opportunity to give you this talk. So today I present some results in this non-commutative quantum field theory and the renormalization. So my talk is organized as follows. I'll start by introduction, a rather lengthy one, in which I recall the renormalization in the usual commutative quantum field theory. I'll then go to the introduction of the non-commutative quantum field theory. I will specify on two particular results, the direct space, the proof of the direct space renormalization of the theory, and then asymptotic safeness of the of one theory or particular model, and then I'll draw some conclusions. So the introductions. It turns out that the physical world, it's organized along a wide range of scales. If we measure them in terms of Planck length, we have about 10 to the power 60 scales. And for each of these scales, we have, for each range of scales, we have some appropriate theory dealing with them. For large scales, we have theories like general relativity and thermodynamics, which describe phenomena occurring at those distances, and for small scales, we have theories like quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, for instance, which give us a very good description of the physics. Now, these theories are not, they are formulated, each one with its set of assumptions and so on, and maybe even axioms. So they don't necessarily go well together. And hence, there are some intermediate phenomena which happen at intermediate scales, which are highly non-trivial. For instance, the quantum Hall effect is an example of a quantum effect, but which occurs for very large samples. So in some sense, it's quantum mechanics, but at a scale which is not appropriate to quantum mechanics. Now, the last scales, the smallest scales, from the mainly the energy of the LHC up to the Planck length, they are the last true unknown of physics, the last true domain of scales we have not accessed yet. And in order to understand physics at that scale, one should try to deepen its understanding of the available theories which work, you know, like, for instance, quantum field theory. Now, quantum field theory is special. Why is it special? Because it is the theory which explains very well the physical phenomena for the last known scales, from the 10 minus 10 to the 10 minus 19 meters. But this quantum field theory, from its beginning, was plagued by a problem, the problem of infinities. First, the first computation in quantum field theory ended up in infinite results, and the meaningful predictions were obtained only after we've devised some way of getting rid of these infinities. And this recipe to get rid of infinities is called renormalization. Now, what renormalization does, so it mainly absorbs the infinities of quantum field theory into some unobservable bare parameters and rewrites the theory in terms of low energy renormalized parameters. And it turns out that actually quantum field theory with this renormalization are arguably the best tested physical theories we have. For instance, this G minus 2, the celebrated G minus 2 factor, we have agreement of computations and experiment which goes beyond the 10 significant decimals. Still, despite its huge explanatory power, renormalization was not easily accepted. So mainly because it was regarded for a long time as an ill-defined recipe just to pull the infinities under the rug in the quantum field theory. And second of all, this is a more of a deep problem of quantum field theory. It turned out in the 50s that an unexpected phenomenon occurred. For most quantum field theories, actually by that time it was for all known quantum field theories, the couplings, the bare couplings, which are the parameter of our development, become infinite at finite cutoff. Now, this must be read in quotations here. Still, the divergence of the bare parameters puts a problem because our initial development, perturbative development, it depends on these bare parameters, and it is highly inconsistent to develop for a small parameters, which it turns out to be infinite. Now, this phenomenon has been called the Landau ghost, and what it happens that it, the first objection was addressed by Wilson in his renormalization group approach, and he translated this unnatural recipe in some analysis of the evolution of parameter number scales. And what about the second problem? So we'll see more about it in the rest of my talk. Now, the standard, the simplest quantum field theory model is the Euclidean 544
model. And it's defined like this. So the, it is given by the partition function, which is this expression, some path integral over some action, which writes like this. Where in this action, lambda is the coupling constant, positive, in order for the theory to be stable, and considered small, the bare coupling should be small, in order for the perturbative development to make sense. Now, M is the mass of the theory, and it multiplies the phi squared term. It gives us a scale of subtraction of the renormalized theory. A is a wave function constant. Usually, we absorb this, we set it to 1, and we redefine, we descale the field phi. And well, the Z0, I set it here. I set it to be a normalization for this partition function, mainly to have to be able to interpret this ill-defined product of d phi's as some kind of normalized Gaussian measure. Now, this ill-defined product, one can either try to define it mathematically correctly or try to think of it as a product of Lebesgue measures at each point of RD. Now, how does renormalization work? So first of all, for renormalization, you need three ingredients. When you do the perturbative development in lambda, we get the this perturbative series is indexed by Farman graphs. If we try to compute the amplitude of graphs, sometimes it turns out to be infinite, sometimes it turns out to be finite. When it's finite, we are glad about it. When it's infinite, we must do something. And what we do, well, we must need a very subtle combination of three ingredients. So the first ingredient for the normalization is the definition of scales. It turns out that a good definition of scales, it's given by the quadratic part of the action, the Hamiltonian. So we will define them starting from this free Hamiltonian, and the renormalization group will always integrate the high scales, the ultraviolet scales, to give an effective theory over the low scales. Now, once the scales are defined for our theory, we need a power counting. This will allow us to classify graphs into convergent graphs. We find the amplitude and the divergent ones. And what we do about the divergent ones? We use a locality principle, which mainly states that any divergent graphs with high internal scales must look in some sense like a point. And if this locality principle is respected, then the infinite amplitude of this graph can be reabsorbed in a redefinition of the coupling constant of our theory. So how does these three concepts apply for the commutative 544 model? So we start with the quadratic part of the action. Actually, we start with its inverse. We call it a propagator, and we can expand this propagator by the Schwinger trick, by some integral over some Schwinger parameter alpha of this heat kernel here, times an infrared regulator, eventually, if we have a mass. Now, the way to introduce scales is to take this propagator and to say that it's a sum over propagators with fixed scales I, where Ci, it is what? It is exactly the same integral, where you have fixed the two bounds of our integral. So it will go from m to the minus 2i plus 1 to the m to the minus 2i, where m is some number larger than 1. Now, for a fixed scale, so a fixed i, we can find easily this kind of a bound. So the m to the power 2i here is due to d alpha over alpha square. And this Gaussian can be bounded by such an exponential decrease in the difference x minus y. The logic is that now we take a Feynman graph, and we decompose it into a sum over scale attribution of its internal propagators. And if a certain propagator has scale I, at fixed scale attribution, it will contribute to a factor m to the power 2i, so the factor here. And if using this exponential decrease here, we try to integrate the point x with respect to y, as this x minus y is the order m minus I, we'll obtain after integration a factor m to the power minus 4i to the four dimensions we have 4x. So now that we've understood a bit how the scales work for this theory, let's see how the power counting works. So Feynman graphs, they are characterized by topological numbers, number of vertices, number of lines, number of external legs. And these four topological numbers respect this relation 4n minus n equals 2l. For an example, for instance, take the bubble graph. It has two internal lines, the red ones, four external legs, the blue ones, and two vertices, the 2 points here. So obviously, they respect the relation. Now, let's see how we analyze the comportment of the amplitude of this graph. So we've seen that we have a sum over slice attributions. Let's suppose that all slices or the propagators in my graph are in the same slice. So for all the lines, I have a prefactor of m to the power 2i. And then I must integrate all the internal points x. For each, I choose a tree in my graph, and I integrate all the points according to this tree. So I will get here m to the minus 4 i's from integration n minus 1 times, because a tree has n minus 1 lines. Now, using this topological relation, I see that this contribution to the amplitude, right, is the sum over the slice index I of m to the power I 4 minus the number of external legs of my graph. Now, obviously, this sum is convergent if ne, the number of external legs, is larger than 4, and is divergent only for 2 and 4 point graphs. So here we recover the usual result that the only 2 and 4 point graphs are divergent. Now, suppose that all the internal propagators for a graph are in a very high scale. So this difference of the internal point is very, very small. It's m minus 2i. So for instance, for the bubble, suppose that these red lines are very, very short, because the I index, the slice index, is considered to be high. Then we see that these two points will become very, very close. So I can graphically represent this situation like, you know, some kind of a point-like contribution here. Now, the leading contribution of the amplitude of this graph, it is divergent, but due to this locality, as I can see that this graph resembles one vertex for the coupling constant lambda, it can be reabsorbed in a definition of the coupling constant lambda. Hence, the 544 theory is renormalizable. So everything goes well. We have a renormalizable theory. We start looking at its flows. And here we encounter Landau's ghost, the celebrated problem. So how does this come about? So the four-point functions, we've seen that they are divergent. They are logarithmically divergent. And they govern the coupling, the flow of the coupling constant lambda. So at one loop, we have only one contribution. It comes from the bubble graph. Now, this bubble graph will give us the following flow equation. Suppose that I want to compute the effective coupling at a scale I minus 1. This equals the effective coupling at a higher scale plus the contribution of the bubble graph. Now, the contribution of the bubble graph is some number, which is positive, times minus lambda squared, because I have two vertices. Now, this flow equation here is d lambda by di equals plus beta, where the sign of beta cannot be changed, times lambda I squared. If I try to change the sign of lambda and to look at the theory of minus lambda, I lose the stability. Hence, this flow equation is the only physical one. And unfortunately, this is a quadratic flow which diverges for a finite cutoff I. Hence, the perturbative computation has no meaning. And in the 60s, all known theories, PEDs, and so on, suffered from this Landau ghost problem. And we see about the situation in quantum field theory in the 60s. Now, it turns in the 70s, the quantum field theory made a spectacular comeback. What happens is that in Weinberg and Salam, they gave a unified theory for weak and electromagnetic interaction in terms of Young and Mills quantum field theory, non-abelian quantum field theory, which has a non-commutative symmetry. Now, Tufte and Veltman proved that these Young-Mills theories are renormalizable. Furthermore, Tufte, in an unpublished work, Politzer, Gross, and Vilcek discovered that these theories do not suffer from the Landau ghost. Hence, the perturbative development is well-defined. And this led to the introduction of QCD and finally the standard model for the particles. Now, around the same time, Wilson came up with his renormalization group approach, which gave a logic to the entire renormalization transformation. So the situation was rather clear. Unfortunately, the price to pay for this scenario here in the Young-Mills theories is that the infrared limit is non-perturbative, because the flow it will grow in the infrared. This gives rise to very interesting phenomena like confinement and so on, which are not so well understood. Now, non-commutative geometry. What is non-commutative geometry? The non-commutative geometry is a framework which generalizes the usual geometrical work, the usual geometrical notions. And let's suppose that we have a theory such that its observables are some commutative algebra of functions, commutative under multiplication. Now, first example of non-commutative geometry is given by quantum mechanics itself. So this classical observables, the functions of the space of the phase on the phase space, they'll become operators on some Hilbert space, and hence they become non-commutative. And we know that one of the first consequences of this non-commutative is that we get some uncertainty principles like delta p times delta x is of order h bar. Now we could interpret this uncertainty relation as a la Feynman. This is a picture he proposed, that suppose that we want to determine the position of an electron. I must illuminate it with a photon. The precision of the of the measurement of the position of the electron is given by lambda, and the precision of a measurement of a momentum of the electron, as the electron is perturbed by this photon, will be of order h over lambda, the momentum of the photon. So the product of the two imprecision must be of order h. Now, one could suppose that at a certain scale, spacetime itself could acquire this particular kind of behavior. For instance, it might happen that at some scale, maybe Planck length, we get some uncertainty relationship in between width and the length for the position observables. Now, how would this come around? Let's take the same experiment, but try to measure the position of the electron on the longitudinal and transverse direction at the same time. On the longitudinal direction, the precision is again given by lambda, but on the transverse direction, well, the photon, it's a form of energy. It has some associated Schwarzschild radius, and the precision of the measurement of the position of the electron is given by this Schwarzschild radius of the photon, which turns out to be the square of the Planck length divided by lambda. The product of the two imprecision is of order Planck length square. As such relations can be physical. Now, actually, the story of quantum field theory, non-commutative quantum field theory, starts much earlier than we would have thought. The first ideas in this direction were advanced by Schrödinger in 34. And actually, initially, it was introduced as a hope to cure the divergences in quantum field theory. People didn't know renormalization. They didn't know this tool of renormalization at that point. They had infinite numbers. And they thought, oh, maybe the non-commutativity of space-time will act like a natural cutoff, which will then render all our computations fine. Now, due to the lack of adequate mathematical tools, and moreover, due to the success of commutative quantum field theory and renormalization, the non-commutative quantum field theory kind of, you know, after the first idea, it kind of entered in a, not in a, in a, in a, in kind of a shadow, in a shadow cone. Now, since the 80s, this theory is reborn. It all started with the work of mathematicians like Alan Kohn and so on, which they formulated, they get the good mathematical cadre for non-commutative geometry. Now, the mathematical work progressed to the 90s, and finally, the first, I think that the founding paper for the modern non-commutative quantum field theory appeared in 96 with the work of Filk, which actually showed that the non-commutative quantum field theory requires renormalization. Hence, the initial hope to cure the ultraviolet divergences by this non-commutativity was proven wrong. Now, in 97, Kohn and Shamseddin derived the standard model action from a spectral action principle applied on a very simple non-commutative space. In 98, Kohn, Douglas, and Schwarz proved that this non-commutative quantum field theory arises in an effective limit of string theory. In 99, Zyberg and Witten, they mapped the non-commutative Young-Mills theory on the ordinary Young-Mills theory. So till the year 2000, everything went well in non-commutative quantum field theory, but Zyberg, Minvalla, and Van Ramsdong, they found a very strange phenomenon characteristic to this non-commutative quantum field theory. It was known as UVRR mixing. We will see it in detail. And this phenomenon prevents the renormalizability of non-commutative quantum field theory. Now, the solution of this mixing is actually not easy to find. And one cure, one proposition was made by Gross and Vulkinar in 2003. In 2006, Friedel and Levin found that the quantum field, some form of non-commutative quantum field theory appears at an effective regime of 3D quantum gravity. And in our group in Orsay, we've started working on the introduction of what we would call the non-commutative renormalization group. So let's take a very simple example of non-commutative geometry. It is given by the Moyal space R for theta. This is just the usual RD space endowed with a star product, which is given by this double integral here. Now, in this integral, theta is considered an anti-symmetric constant matrix. And this product is non-commutative. It was built to be non-commutative. It is associative. And it has it is tracial, that is, the integral of f star g equals the integral of f pointwise product with g. This technical property will prove important in the future. Now, one could try to understand this Moyal product in the following way. So suppose I want to compute the product of f and g at the point x. So I take the f at the point x plus y, I take g at the point x plus z, I make the product of the two, and I multiply everything by an oscillating factor here, which oscillates with the area of this triangle x, x plus y, x plus z. Now, if we do some trivial computations, we see that the star product x mu times g equals the pointwise product plus some derivative term. And if we do it the other way around, g star x mu, we get the pointwise product minus this derivative term. So hence, we see that it's non-commutative. Now, if in particular for the g we take another coordinate function, we get here the theta mu nu entry of the matrix, which we consider constant. And we see that such a constant commutation relation between the two x mu and x mu could give gives rise actually to an uncertainty principle of the form we've seen two transparencies ago. Now, to simplify a bit our life, we'll take theta in this form, in Jordan form, and we suppose that the two eigenvalues are equal. This is not very, it is easy to always project in this situation. And one could note that we recover the commutative product as theta goes to zero, but beware, this is usually a highly involved limit. And it is not, this limit is not at all easy to take. So we'll try not to discuss it. Now we had the simplest model, the simplest non-commutative geometry. Let's put on it the simplest quantum field theory model we can think of. So this is again the 5-4 model.
Because the theta has a very bad habit of appearing in the denominator sometimes. So when you take theta to zero, you have quantities which explode and they are very difficult to control. So coming back, we took the 5-4 model.
And the idea is to put stars all over it. So the interaction term will now be phi star phi star phi star phi star phi. And you see that here in the quadratic term, I didn't put any star. This is due to the triciality. I can either put or not the star here because the integral will not take into account this. Now the propagator of this model, it is given by minus delta plus mu zero, 1/-delta+μ0, which is exactly the same as the usual propagator. So here nothing changed. On the other hand, the vertex of this model is modified. So this integral can be written as an integral of phi in x1, phi in x2, phi in x3, phi in x4 times the kernel, where this kernel can be understood in the following way. The delta function of x1 minus x2 plus x3 minus x4 forces the four corners of the vertex, x1, x2, x3, and x4, to be on the corners of a parallelogram. Moreover, the oscillating factor here is proportional to the area of this parallelogram. So our vertices are oriented parallelograms, which have an oscillation proportional with their area. Now, due to this non-locality in the interaction, the topological structure of our Feynman graphs will be much richer. We'll have vertices and propagators, but we'll have something we call faces. We'll have broken faces. We'll have, again, the external legs, and we'll have a genus for the graph. Now, these different topological numbers are related by two topological relations. The first one is that the Euler characteristic of a graph, which is 2 minus 2g, equals the number of vertices minus the numbers of lines plus the number of faces. Yes?
So the faces
we'll see them exactly on the next transparencies. I'll present them in detail on the next transparency. I'll give some examples of graphs. The 4 points don't coincide, no. They have to be on a, in the corners of a parallelogram, so certainly on a plane. Okay. So this first topological relation is here, and the second one is the usual one, which we see in the commutative model also, that 4n minus the number of external legs equals twice the number of lines. Now, as Liv very well noticed, one should present a bit the graphs of this theory. So let's take several examples. Yep. Because I said that this product has a triciality property, that integral of f star g equals integral of f g. So let's take integral of d mu phi, this is the usual term. I put a star in it to make it moyal, but due to triciality, I can forget about it. So it's just not there. Okay? So, any other questions?
So the language of planar, non-planar diagram,
Yes, actually there exists a basis
which will appear a bit later in my talk, which is a matrix base, and this model maps on a matrix model. Let's first try to understand how these notions of faces and so on appear in the direct space. So take the example of a graph. It is a usual sunshine graph. It has two vertices, the two parallelograms here. It has two external legs, so the small half lines here. Now it has three lines, 1, 2, 3. It has three faces. How do we see a face? We turn around the graph without ever crossing any line, any propagator, or any vertex. So for instance, here I have a cycle which turns inside here, which is, I will call F1, one face. Here I have a second cycle which turns inside here, just the second face. And on the exterior, I have another cycle. Here on the external legs, I suppose it just jumps, which ends here. So this graph will have three faces. The number of faces broken by external legs, well, this is one because it's only the F3 which is broken by external legs. The other two faces don't have any external legs. And if I plug these numbers in the Euler characteristic relation, I see that this graph has genus zero. So this is what we'll call a planar one broken face graph. Now another more complicated example is to take the sunshine graph and to permute these two endpoints for these two lines. So now we'll have the two vertices, the two external legs again. We have the three lines, 1, 2, 3. But let's count the faces, so we'll follow the cycle. We go here, we enter inside, we go down, up on the outside, and it ends there. So it has only one face. Now this face is broken by external legs, obviously. And if I plug this number into the Euler characteristic relation, I see that this graph has genus one. So this is a non-planar graph. Now, a third example of graph, it is the same sunshine graph where I just put this external leg inside here. So it has two vertices, it has two external legs, it has three lines, and it has three faces because I have these three cycles independent. But the number of broken faces is two because both F1 and F3 have external legs. The genus of this graph, if I plug these numbers, turns out to be zero. So here I have a planar graph with one broken face. Here I have a planar graph with more than one broken face. And here I have a non-planar graph. Now, it turns out that for this model, only planar graphs with one broken face diverge. These graphs have the form of the initial Lagrangians. Thus, the theory seems renormalizable. But it is not. And this is due to the UV-IR mixing. Where this UV, yes?
There are these phase factors.
Yes.
Okay, so you're saying for planar graphs, those same phase factors go away?
Actually, I will present this a bit because this phenomenon must happen also in the renormalizable theory. Mainly what happens is the following thing is that because the graph is planar, in some sense, when the internal scales are high, all the internal corners are very close. So what I get a planar paving of the plane. Such a planar paving of parallelograms. It's always a parallelogram from the point of view of the external legs. And the area of the parallelogram is obviously the sum of the internal paving. So yes, the planar one broken face graphs are exactly the form of such a Moyle kernel. And hence the theory seems renormalizable. What forbids renormalization is this phenomenon. Actually, it wasn't noted. There even existed some papers which claim that the model is renormalizable because this phenomenon is very strange. It does not appear the first or second order of perturbations. It appears, I think, the first one, you truly see it only at the fourth order of perturbation or something like this. So people just said, OK, this theory should be renormalizable. This problem is given by the non-planar tadpole. What is this non-planar tadpole? So it's a graph which is actually planar, but it has two broken faces represented here, one vertex with this internal line and the two half lines there. Now, the amplitude of this graph, if we compute it, is the integral of the internal momentum of this oscillation factor times the usual propagator, so which will have, for very small external momenta k, to have a behavior like 1 over k squared. Now, this in itself, it is not problematic. What is problematic is that if we now try to insert this non-planar tadpole many times in a loop, in any loop, we'll collect many 1 over k squared factors. So for any loop, the integral over that loop at some order of perturbation will behave like d4k over k to the power 2n. And this integral is divergent in the infrared region. Now, this divergence makes that any graph will become at some point divergent if I start just inserting this non-planar tadpole in it. And unfortunately, or fortunately, these divergences cannot be cured by the counterterms of the form of the initial actions. Hence, the model.
here in front of something like it. Yes, I never try to take the limit theta to zero, I kind of forget about the powers of theta. I tend to forget.
2-point functions rather than 3-point functions, right?
This is actually, it affects all the functions because I can take an arbitrary function, I can just plug it inside this graph.
If non-commutative field theory were normalizable, then only, you know, at the loop level you would modify like 3-point function, 4-point function, right? Where theta enters in your 3-level Lagrange. Here it appears in 2-point function.
Here it appears, yes. This problem appears only for the 2-point function, but the main problem is that if I take any arbitrary function from the point of view of the external legs, I can insert this guy everywhere. So actually it affects all the arbitrary points. But
my point is that if you see that the 2-point function is altered and initially it was not there, right, then
yes,
your starting point is wrong, right? That you've got to introduce.
Yes, yes. And actually from this idea came also the solution to this mixing, and now we have two solutions. I'll insist on one, and the second one I'll just briefly mention. So the first solution is what we call the balkanized model. What does this mean? Well, it turns out that the vertex of this model has a very non-trivial duality property. It is invariant under a cyclic, complete cyclic Fourier transform of its arguments. So the kernel of the vertex in momentum space is equal to the kernel of the moment of the vertex in the x in the direct space. Hence, the idea of Gross and Vulkenard was to modify the propagator to obey the same duality property. Now the Fourier transform of the P of the minus delta is a harmonic potential term. So let's add a harmonic potential term, omega square x tilde square. With this extra term, we have this kind of covariance property of the propagator under the between the direct and the momentum space. The important fact about this theory is that this model is renormalizable at all orders in perturbation theory. Now, obviously, this idea has been criticized, and there are mainly two critics which have been brought. The first one is that this harmonic potential is an infrared cutoff, so it is not surprising that it will cure the ultraviolet infrared mixing, which is a problem for small k. If you put a cutoff, then you will not see the small k's. Now, the second is that this term obviously breaks translation invariance, so this model cannot be applied to some translation invariant physics. Now, I'll try to answer a bit this criticism. The first one is that actually the harmonic potential, it is not just an innocent infrared cutoff. It is a term which will transform the theory into a renormalizable theory. Moreover, this term will grow under the renormalization. The omega will have a flow which will flow it to one under renormalization. So in some sense, the slightest perturbation in this direction will just regularize the theory. Yep.
The
Lagrangian
that it began with didn't have translation
invariance. No, it didn't have
rotational
Lorentz. This guy has translation invariance. The vertex has. Because if I create a parallelogram and I translate it, it remains a parallelogram and its area does not change. So he's translation invariant. They are translation invariant. He is not. So it's the term which breaks the translation invariance.
So the interaction depends on the theta, so how can you say that?
Translation. Just translation. I'm talking just about translation, not rotation, not nothing.
Okay.
Yes?
You?
Yeah. What is the backup? What can you write what is the Fourier transform of the propagator with the omega in it? Just to see whether.
So I must Fourier. So, okay. For the propagator 1 over minus delta plus m square, plus omega square x square, plus m square. Okay, would you allow me to go to the next to the transparency after next, and then I write this formula? Because what is the problem? The way to take this Fourier transform, it's a bit involved, because here I have a differential operator down here. The way to do it is to write some Schwinger development, m minus alpha times this operator here, call it h, and then to Fourier transform this integral here. And I see that it is invariant under Fourier transform. For that, I need to explicitate this kernel. It will be explicitated shortly.
This is as if
the mass increases at, with the square of the distance from the origin. So the particle, as the particle tries to go out from the origin, there's an origin, and as it tries to go out from the origin, it gets heavier and heavier.
Yes,
it
you
goes
put
further from the origin.
This is true, but I prefer to associate this term more with this one, that is the mass. Because the two are interchanged under Fourier transform, I prefer to not to think of this one as a mass. I think of it as, I don't know, some kind of combining potential, if you want, but not really a mass for my particles. Okay, so back to the critics. So, okay, the about the first so that I addressed it, and the second one, well, actually, it's true that this model is not Nasish invariant, but still, it can be, it might be connected in some non-trivial ways to some transition invariant physics. And most importantly, actually, there is another renormalizable model what we introduce, which comes to add a two-point term which goes like 1 over p squared. Now, this term gives a renormalizable theory. Again, this model does not break transition invariance again. However, one, the infrared limit is difficult to take. Two, the phenomenon of asymptotic safeness, which is one of the nicest things about the Gross-Volkenar model, is lost for this 1 over p squared model. Hence, in some sense, although non-natural, this solution seems to be better adapted to the problem.
If you Fourier transform x squared, you get 1 over p squared.
If you Fourier transform x squared, you get minus delta. So okay, you have x squared. If you Fourier transform this guy, it will give you the second derivative of p. This is a differential operator. If you write the kernel of this guy, so it is, in some sense, 1 over p squared is the first contribution of the kernel of this guy, but here I make it a complete, I think the complete guy. Okay.
Only in four dimensions.
So I certainly know that these two methods work in four dimensions, and I suspect they might work also in higher dimensions. What happens is that the 5-4 model by itself is not just denormalizable in higher dimensions, so in some sense you should look at different interactions in higher dimensions. Okay, so here it will be a bit of technical transparency. We try to apply the same Schwinger trick for this propagator. So as I wrote here, turns out that this exponential of e minus alpha h has this kernel in the direct space. It involves some hyperbolical functions here, okay, rather complicated. What is important is that it's Gaussian in xy, x minus y and x plus y. So obviously, if I take this guy and I Fourier transform it, I get exactly the same, I get a Gaussian. And it turns out that the factors are just conspire to give the same Gaussian, with the only difference that omega will this time go, you know, omega will go in 1 over omega. So on the form of this kernel, you understand the duality under a double Fourier transform. I could put a mass. This would give me a fb to the minus alpha m squared. But I don't really need it, because this this guy has no infrared problem. In the infrared, you see that this decrease here goes to, so this guy will act like 1, this one will be like 1. So okay, I have just some decrease. And the amplitude of a graph for such a model will be such a complicated expression, where I have one Mellor kernel for each internal line of the graph, and one vertex factor for each vertex. Now, actually, it turns out that this expression is simpler than it looks. The first idea is to make a change of variable inspired by the form of the propagator. You see that here, the variables which intervene are the difference in the sum of the two endpoints of a line. Hence, I introduce what I will call a short variable, which will be the difference of the two endpoints. It is short, why? Because in the ultrawide region, so while alpha is small, this hyperbolical cotangent will be like 1 over alpha. So this will constrain x minus y to be rather short in the ultraviolet. The converse holds for the sum, x plus y, which by this term it's allowed to be rather large in the small alpha limit. Now, in terms of these two variables, I will introduce a slicing. As before, the slicing is take the integral expression and cut it with two in between two limits. And in one slice, I have this kind of bound. The same m to the power 2y as in the usual commutative case. The difference, so the short variable, has the same decrease in m to the power I. But I also have an extra decrease, a very slow decrease, in m to the power minus I for the long variable. Now, how come this model is renormalizable? We had the slicing. We'll now try to do some rough power counting for the model. On average, for each vertex, we have two propagators. This is due to the relation 4n minus ne equals 2l. So 4n, it's almost 2l up to some external legs factors. Now, for each vertex, we must integrate two short variables u and two short variables v. And every vertex, each propagator, you must integrate two short variables, two long variables. And each vertex has one delta function of the parallelogram. So let's suppose that we have all the propagators in the same slice, and let's try to evaluate the contribution of this slice to the total amplitude. So we have m to the power 4i for the two prefactors of the two propagators. The two u variables, I'll integrate them with this decrease here. Each one will bring me m to the minus 4i, so I'll have a 2 m to the minus 8i from the u integration. One of the v variables, I integrate it with this decrease, so this makes me pay this factor. And the last v variable, I integrate it with this delta function. So this will not cost me anything. It will be an integral of order O of 1. If I look at this expression, it is neutral from the power counting point of view. A detailed analysis will show that only 2 and 4 point graphs may be divergent. If you notice, in this rough power counting, we use the delta function of the vertex, but not the oscillations. So what is the contribution of the oscillations? Well, it turns out that the complete vertex factor of a graph can be written in terms of a reduced graph, which is known as the rosette, which is obtained as following. I take my initial graph, and I contract all the lines in a tree. For instance, for the sunshine graph, if I consider this line, this red line, as a tree line, I will get this rosette, which has one vertex and the two lines, L1 and L2. For such a graph, I have only factors which involve the external legs eventually and the internal short ultraviolet variables. Now, for the second type of graph, choosing this red one to be a tree line, I will get this kind of rosette graph, which has one crossing. The two lines L1 and L2 will cross on the rosette. Whenever I have such a crossing in this rosette, I have a term which is an oscillation of the two long ultraviolet variables V. And the third case is when I have, for the third graph, when I have some external leg which is in the interior of a line, like here, which breaks an internal phase. And such a configuration will give me a contribution which will oscillate the position of this external leg with the long variable of this line. So before, when we did the rough power counting, we paid one of the V variables with the integration factor in the propagator. But what happens is that if ever I have a factor like this, the second one of these V variables should not be paid, because I can integrate it with this oscillation, which must be of order O of 1. So if this V is large, this forces this other V to be small. So instead of paying it, we'll gain by integration over V2. Hence, for non-planar graphs, whenever I have such an oscillation, I use it, and I get an improvement in my previous power counting. And whenever I have a graph which has more than one broken phase, I get again an improvement. Then these improvements are enough to ensure that only planar graphs with one broken phase are divergent. And as we've seen before, they must have either two or four external legs. So we've seen the slicing. We've seen the power counting. Let's see what happens with the locality. So the locality, yes?
How do you choose which lines to contract? Would you contract all lines? Or
here, I choose the lines in a tree. It turns out that for a given graph, no matter what tree I choose, the topological characteristic of this guy, it's of the reduced graph, genus and number of broken faces, is the same. So all graphs are identical. This is a bit like momentum rooting. When you do momentum rooting in a graph, you can choose any tree, you root with that tree. This is a kind of, let's call it position. Actually, we call it like that. So the locality. So we want to subtract graphs with ultraviolet internal scales. Now, ultraviolet internal scales, that means that the short variables are really very short. So the two endpoints of a line are very close. So if we take the bubble, these propagators here must be very short, which will give us this kind of a figure of graph. Now here, as this is a parallelogram, this line is parallel and equal with this one, and parallel and equal with this line. So from the point of view of the external legs, this will form a parallelogram. Moreover, for this example, it's trivial that the area of this red parallelogram is equal with the sum of the two blue areas. Now this translates in the following slightly technical lemma, that the vertex contribution for a planar regular graph, planar regular means planar with only one broken face, translates like this enormous expression. But what must one understand from this expression is the following, is that in the ultraviolet, the U variables are short. So the leading contribution is when then I set them to zero. If I set them to zero, I see that this line disappears, and these variables disappear from there. So the first line, the blue factors completely decouple from the rest. The blue factors exactly reconstitute a Moyle kernel, and the rest of the factor enters in a divergent integral, but this integral can be reabsorbed in a redefinition of the coupling constant because I have a Moyle kernel from the point of view of the external legs. Now, once this model is understood, I'll slightly present the most fascinating thing about it, is the fact that it does not have a Landau ghost. So how does this happen? Well, it turns out that the model is asymptotically safe, meaning that the coupling of the flow of the coupling constant is bounded. Hence, if the flow is bounded, perturbative computation have a sense. I can develop in the ultraviolet and get a perturbative development. And this, it's very important because this also opens the road towards a complete non-perturbative construction of the model. Now, how can this happen? There are, the main point is that in this model, you have two parameters, omega and lambda, which flow. So you have a coupled flow. And these omega parameters will flow to one in the ultraviolet region. And when omega equals one, the flow of lambda stops. It just stops at some value. Now what happens is that it turns out that if I set omega equal to one from the beginning in order to do my computations, I see that the beta function of the model is zero at all orders in perturbation theory. Now this result has been obtained in several steps. So first there's an article by Gross and Vulkenar which show that omega indeed flows to one in the ultraviolet and that lambda will fix to some constant. Their result has been generalized at three loops by Dizadori and Ivasso. We show that if I set my omega to one, then the fact that lambda is a constant holds up to three loops. But as we want to prove this the fact that this beta function is zero, that the lambda is a constant, we must check at all orders because we could always assume that, I don't know, at the 20th order, I have some non-trivial correction of this lambda. Hence, I cannot state that it will just go to a constant. And this has been checked by the authors here. And actually, it turns out that the proof at all orders, it's much shorter than any of the perturbative computations. Yes?
In the proof. Yes. The paper, there seemed to be a comment that there were quote-unquote irrelevant terms which were thrown away.
Yes.
So you throw away these terms because they're smaller than the infrared, but in the ultraviolet, there's no reason to expect them to be small, so...
We'll never end this discussion. Okay.
Maybe we can have this discussion at the end of the talk, or because we haven't seen the proof, so we don't know what you're referring to. No?
Yes.
Are you going to talk about this problem?
What happens is that actually, because the time runs a bit out, I was planning on showing how it happens at the first order, state the general theorem, give some idea of the proof without going into the details. But if you want, I have some transparencies after the last transparency where I present also the proofs. So if you're interested, I can show you this all order proofs. Okay. So how does it come about? Yes?
Before that, can I ask a very dumb question?
Yes.
Omega is a dimensional constant?
Omega is dimensionless because the thing I added in the action was p squared plus omega squared x tilde squared. But this tilde here is actually a dimensionful tilde. So this omega gets dimensionless.
But does omega goes to zero in the infinite? If you want to use this model, you want to restore, translation invariance for long-range physics.
So omega decreases in the infinite. It does not go. It never touches exactly zero in the infinite. So if you start with an omega which is smaller than one, because if it's equal to one, it will stay one. If you start with an omega which is smaller than one, it will flow in the infinite, but it will not reach zero ever. So it will always have here some non-trivial omega. Why does this happen? Because actually, if you look in this problem, you have only half of a direction of the normalization group. This is particularly clear in the matrix space, which I introduced right now, actually. And it turns out that this flow will never be able to go and continue up to zero. If this is a problem, we try to go around it. We try to do some way of, gluing
several models like this to get some Bayesian invariant model, and I admit we haven't yet succeeded. So in some sense, yes, the transition symmetry, the transitional invariance is still lost, and I don't know how to restore it.
It's not necessary. I don't. You know, if you look at the quantum mechanics in the constant magnetic field, and you choose some gauge potential that you know B times X, you square it, you look at it, and it looks totally translationally non-invariant, but the physics is translational.
Yes, because it's invariant after magnetic translations. Unfortunately, this model is not invariant for the translation magnetic translation side. So it truly breaks the. So what happens if you are in a? We actually looked a bit at this problem. If you are in a background magnetic field, you have something like minus delta plus omega squared x squared plus omega or twice omega dx. Now this is a very good propagator. I can try to repeat. Well, actually, it turns out that I encountered the lambda with the first lambda level singularity. It has a very degenerate spectrum, and it is very, it is not adapted to do some slicing, because its spectrum is what? Have very well separated levels with high degeneracy. How can you slice this? You either have no level, or at some point you get an infinity of them. It is not adapted to slicing. Unfortunately, our problem is not similar to this one, and it truly breaks transition invariance, and I admit it's still something to be discussed.
Concerning transition invariance, I mean, also something is hidden in this x tilde. That is, x tilde, I guess, is x over theta.
Yeah.
So even if omega is small, a priori you want theta to be small, which means that omega over theta is huge.
If you
so there's no regime where you can restore, you know, not seeing the non-commutativity and not seeing the breaking of the transition invariance. So
there's
a regime where either you have high non-commutativity or high non-translation invariance. Is that the case?
So the point is like this. We have this theta here. We also have a theta in the vertex, actually. So my lambda, it also has some thetas which are hidden there. I have also thetas in the exponential of the vertex. It is, if I try to take, looking at the Lagrangian, the 9 limit theta to 0, or some correlated limit theta and omega, I have very very hard time dealing with this interaction also. So unfortunately, the problem, as I stated, is I fix theta or something, I look at the flow of omega, and I know that it flows in between 1 and I don't know what. For now, I don't try to correct this model to some low energy physics. Okay? So, another interesting point of view on this model is given by this matrix space. So one could, a la limit, you know, one could say that, okay, let's study this matrix model without trying to connect it, not even, I don't know, with Moyal space or whatever. It turns out that at omega exactly equals 1, which is the ultraviolet fixed point, I can develop my fields over some basis of function, which actually are just Hermite polynomials, so these are not two, such that the Moyal product becomes a simple matrix product. Now, in this matrix base, the action of this model becomes this expression here. Well, I put here some bars to signal a complex model. I could just forget about them. It's a real model. Both of them have the zero beta function. Now, these terms here are given by a trace of a product of three matrices. Now, this is actually a constant. It's not a matrix. A times the identity. And X is some diagonal constant which has the entries M times delta MN. So it's something like 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on and so forth. With the interaction, which is a trace of a product of four phis. Now, if I take a complex model, due to the symmetry of this vertex, I just choose a 2 for normalization of lambda. It's not 2. So the propagator of this model is the inverse of the quadratic part. Now, this is easy to see. Actually, this guy becomes an M times delta MN. This one becomes an N times delta MN. So the inverse of the quadratic part is given by 1 over M plus N plus this mass A, which actually it is at least 1/2. So this mass is certainly higher than 1/2. It is easy to understand because the harmonic oscillator has the fundamental at 1/2. So this is certainly a number. Even if the physical mass is set to 0, this is at least 1/2. Now, if I deal with the complex model, I can also orient the propagator from 5 bar to 5.
Now, in this matrix model, well, it is rather classical. Propagators become just ribbons, which transmit the two indexes, m and, well, here we should read n. And the vertex becomes just a crossroad of four ribbons, which transmit indexes on its sides. So k equals m, it's equal with m, n with n, k with k, and l with l. Now, one must build Feynman graphs starting from these vertices and propagators. So let's take some examples. First example, it's a tadpole, just a naive tadpole. I have these half lines here, which I just drew like with dots, because I consider the imputed tadpole. And I could also look at the imputed bubble. Now, it turns out that this tadpole has an inside index d. And if I try to compute its amplitude, well, it's some factor times a coupling constant times a sum over this internal index of the propagator which with sides d and b. So this is sum over d of 1 over d plus b plus a, which obviously is a divergence sum. And the amplitude for the bubble, well, some factor, some symmetry factor also, times the internal sum of this index m, which is trapped in the interior, and the product of two propagators, one a plus m plus capital A, and the other c plus m plus capital A. Now, how does the normalization? Yes.
This is completely combinatorical. There's no more orientation or over or under.
These factors here are chosen for the complex model. So actually, I have an orientation over on this on every of these propagators, which is not explicit. In some sense, one must distinguish in the complex model between the tadpole which goes like this and the tadpole which goes like this. So here I just set the factor of the up tadpole. Why did I do this? Because I want to exactly fix these factors and to check that the first order explicitly that the beta function is zero. So I needed to specify precisely this.
What you're doing. And the vertex, you didn't say what the vertex was for the matrix. Well, the vertex is just a trivial.
The vertex is just the matrix vertex which contains indexes with a lambda here, and that's
there's no more phase factor.
No, that is the beauty of this basis. All the phases which are hidden in the star become simple matrix products. So this is truly a matrix model. You can just state it like this, forget about all Moya and everything. I have this matrix model, I state that its beta function is zero at all orders in perturbation. I can analyze it like that. So here I have the graph, okay? So how does the normalization work in this matrix space? Well, that is the second bit of technicality in this presentation. I want to look how the two-point function renormalizes. So I wrote here the complete connected two-point function, and I claim it is equal with this expression. Now, this actually is rather familiar. It's a classical quantum field theory computation. I say that my complete connected function, G2, which is something represented like that, is the sum of one propagator plus one propagator, one particle irreducible two-point function and one propagator, plus, and so on and so forth. Hence, the complete function is C over 1 minus C times sigma, the sum of these geometrical C's. Now, I invert it to get my effective Hamiltonian if you want. Turns out to be, so this C will go with this one, and here I get the C minus 1, which is simple m plus n plus a, minus this two-point function sigma. Now, this two-point function can be Taylor developed. I have a first term, sigma with fixed indexes at 0, 0, and 0, and the second term, which comes from the derivatives. Well, it turns out that if the derivative acts on m or on n, actually the two are equal because left and right are separated, but they are symmetric. I can always change left and right. Hence, this Taylor development will give me m plus n times some factor plus a minus d sigma plus some small corrections. So, if you notice, even in the direct space, the UV and the infrared have disappeared. Where are they hidden? Even in the direct space, I had my parameter alpha, which went from 0 to infinity d alpha. And I said alpha close to 0 is my ultraviolet. Alpha close to infinity is my infrared. Ultraviolet and infrared are not defined in terms of distance. As you see here, I have only half a direction of randomization group. It goes from ultraviolet, from the 0 to the infinity here. But in the direct space, I had some factors here which actually make that the region from 1 to infinity didn't count. So actually, this guy goes only to 1. What happens in the matrix space? Well, in the matrix space, I have matrices. And my ultraviolet is a large matrix. Here I have
lambda, the number of lines and columns, is very large. If I integrate some ultraviolet slice, I'll just take here some corner that I integrated, and I look at the effective theory, and so on and so forth. So I go from the ultraviolet to the infrared, but I see that I stop here because I cannot have a magnitude which is smaller than 1/1. So I have only one direction of the normalization groups. It goes from high indexes to small indexes. Okay? Okay? Okay. So I look at this relation. I identify this irreducible two-point function with the external indexes set to zero as a quadratic mass normalization. So it is expected the mass is quadratic. And this 1 minus derivative of sigma is a wave function normalization. It's a multiplicative normalization of this m plus n.
So here, when you mean
sorry,
equivalent, you mean
sorry,
what?
We're waiting to the end of the question,
yeah.
So we get close.
Yeah, I just want to understand the formula. So
this formula there, it's up to irrelevant terms. So,
no, but it's in the large n, it's in the...
Pardon?
It's in which limit? The equivalent, large n, small n?
No, it's up to irrelevant terms. So, this is complete two-point function, okay? I can make a general power counting and state that the complete one-particle least square two-point function, blah, 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 is quadratically divergent. I can identify sigma of 0, so this is true for any m and n. I identify sigma of 0, 0 as a quadratic divergence. So this is quadratically divergent. With this cutoff, which is the dimension of the matrix, okay? I have the d sigmas, well, as I have an extra derivative, they'll be only logarithmically divergent. Any 2d which acts will give me something which is convergent with the cutoff. So this approximative means up to convergent terms in the cutoff, okay? So this is a wave function normalization. And how does one define the effective coupling? So starting from the one particular irreducible four-point function, as we have on average two propagators by vertex, the effective coupling is the ratio of this one particular irreducible four-point function by the square of the wave function normalization. Now this equality is defined for power series. You see that gamma 4 and z squared, they are infinite power series in lambda. Hence this equation, it's rather complicated. Well, let's compute this effective coupling as one loop. So we had only the top which contributes to this sigma, which we get after derivative. If you remember that we had on 1/p, now if we derivate, we have 1/p squared. The four-point function will be given by the first, the one vertex plus the power substitution. If we make the ratio of the two, we see that the effective coupling equals the bare coupling plus something which is of order lambda squared. Where here, these are, you know, two, if you want, divergent series, but in the ratio, they just cancel each other. So lambda effective is equal to lambda first order, and actually it turns out that this generalizes the statement. The one particular reducible four-point function, gamma 4, which is a power series in lambda, equals minus lambda times the product of these two power series in lambda. And this holds up to some fine terms in total orders in perturbation. But the proof of this statement relies on two tools. A Dyson equation, which gives us an evolution equation for the four-point function, and the set of Ward identity, which are associated to an idea presenting the homomorphic covariance of the theory, underlying of this theory. Now, I'll start here the technical part of the talk, and just to present some other results we obtained in this non-commutative quantum field theories. So we found bounds for other classes of propagators, namely this kind of propagators, but where the coefficients here are slightly different. If we put here some b, if they are not different, we cannot do anything. But if we put a small b in a magnetic field and an extra confining potential, we can get some bounds of propagator, which allows one to try to put some Moyano interaction on these theories and see if we get renormalizable models. We also introduced the parametric representation of such models. Well, it is, as everybody knows, a compact expression for the amplitude. It actually appears to some new topological objects, which are the generalization of trees in the usual quantum field theory, which we call pi trees. Moreover, this expression, this parametric representation, exhibits this democracy of pi trees. Hence, each such topological object contributes the same factor to the amplitude, which actually gets rid of the annoying problem that we had in the X space of choosing a tree in order to contract our Z. And it turns recently out that this related to some topological ribbon polynomials introduced by this Borobash and Riordan, which are some generalization of ribbon field polynomials. We also performed the dimensional equalization of renormalization of the model. As everybody knows, this is a procedure which does not break the geodetic variance. It's true that you don't yet possess Young-Mills, which is renormalizable. Hopefully, when it will happen, the proof will be done using this kind of tools. This dimensional equalization was also used to introduce the Hofmann algebra point of view on renormalization. We also defined a complete Melanov representation of the model, which allows one to access the behavior and the risk gauging of Euclidean invariants. And finally, as already mentioned, we studied the model with A over P squared term, but you know what happened. So, conclusion, starting from Philip's work, we know that non-modal quantum the theory must be renormalized. And actually, we proved that it can be renormalized with the condition of changing the notions of ultraviolet and infrared, exactly what Laurent has pointed. These scales of ultraviolet and infrared are not associated with distances, they become spectral, they're associated with a spectrum of a particular operator, the free Hamiltonian of the theory. Now, the power counting is related to the topology of the Feynman-Gras, and it becomes more involved. It depends on the genus, on faces, and so on and so forth. The locality needs to be revised for this particular model. It needs to be replaced with what we call the moiality. And well, the quantum field theory is better behaved because on non-commutative quantum on non-commutative spaces, because you see we have no Landau ghost. And it seems that actually we can fully build it at non-perturbative level. And well, as these flows are modified by this phenomenon, one could say that if ever this non-commutative quantum field theory appears in nature, one could give testable predictions. We would see the modification of running of constant. Now, what lies beyond the non-commutative quantum field theory? So, as already said, it appears an effective regime in both string theory and loop quantum gravity. Hence, one could consider it as a good toy theory to allow one to pursue this quantization of gravity. Now, like string theory and the group field theory, it relies on functional integration of Feynman graphs, but it implements the covariance under diffeomorphism, which I, as I said, is the main reason behind the fact that the flow is modified, and then the fact that the scales of the theory become spectral. It's obvious that once we have this covariance under diffeomorphism, one cannot relate scales to short and large distances because they can be interchanged. So this has this spectrality for the scales consequence and this modification of the flows as a consequence. But this naive concept of scale does not apply to loop quantum gravity either, because that is a theory which is invariant under the full diffeomorphism group. But nevertheless, one could hope that spectral scales could be defined, and hence one could hope that a diffeomorphism invariant renormalization group can exist. That's.
Let's say we have 5 minutes for questions, and then if you have further questions, you can have lunch with Rosman.
I cut Oliver's question, so I can ask.
Oliver, go ahead.
So, what's your problem? Yes, tell me.
Well, so as I understand the paper, I made this point in the paper. It seemed that certain